And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
Welcome back to another edition of Chatter on Books. This is our Super Bowl edition, right?
That's absolutely right. Let's spend the next 55 minutes talking about how that was the worst
Super Bowl of all time. Super Bowl of all time.
Well, help people sleep. Anybody who's having difficulty sleeping with all the troubles in the world these days.
That's Tori Clark. She's obviously a Pittsburgh Steelers fan. She's upset that the record has been tied for most Super Bowl wins by a franchise.
Only tied.
My name is Mark Stern. We're here with Michael Kornheiser and Gina McManus. And we've got a fun show for you.
We do. We're here at Chatter at the corner of Wisconsin and Jennifer Streets Northwest. And I am so happy, A, the sun is out, and B, it's not raining.
It's like 58 degrees outside.
I think this is the first time we've done this show.
It felt like an early spring day.
It did.
We're not huddled here, like freezing.
I usually have two or three shirts on under a sweater and then a jacket and my little, you know, silver down jacket on. Not today. It's lovely.
It is lovely.
Yeah. And we got the coach coming in later this evening, correct?
That's right. Coach's show is back at 7 o'clock.
So we have a hard stop at 6:30.
Yes.
Anybody who's paying attention, Tori? Okay.
Just to give folks a heads up, we're reformatting the show.
We are.
We're breaking it up a little bit. There's going to be some new sounds that you might hear and just a little bit of a different feel. This was a high-level production meeting.
Tori's idea, which Mark gets to reject if it doesn't work.
No. Yeah. We're all on board with this. We vote like the Communist Party. It's always unanimous.
All right. What we've got on tap this evening, we're going to start with Guilty Pleasures, Comfort Food for Books, which I think is particularly appropriate now that you know, we're past New Year's and all those super resolutions. We get to eat what we want, do what we want, read what we want. We're going to try a new segment, which is The Genius of Michael Kornheiser, which right now we're loosely calling Book Tank, but it's the book report. And that's going to be, Mark is going to be challenged to read a book.
Oh, so it's me first.
Yeah, you volunteered.
The idea is to make Mark uncomfortable.
Yeah, I don't remember volunteering. I said we should do this as an idea.
We did. We sat here 10 days ago, Michael, you were my witness, right after I'd come back from Vietnam, and we sat there and we were talking about new segments, and you said, you know, my idea, I think we ought to have each one of us pick a book.
I volunteer as tribute.
Yeah.
I do not recollect any of these statements.
All right, so it's your turn.
Get ready.
It's your turn.
Yeah, okay.
It's your turn in the box.
But
go
there's
for
been
it.
Some chatter.
No.
See what I did right there?
Yeah.
There's been some chatter about what kind of book you guys are going to assign me.
Just wait.
And I think it's almost punitive.
Just wait. Yeah,
it is. It'll be payback time for you. Okay. That's all I'm saying.
It's going to be serious books, which is what this show is not about.
Okay.
But speaking of serious, we also have our guest authors, that is plural, Eric Schmidt and Tom Shanker of the New York Times, who are national security, terrorism, you name it, experts, and they are the authors of a really important book called Counterstrike, which is the untold story of America's campaign against Al-Qaeda, which the book came out a few years ago. Everyone should read it, and it's very current.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very current. Lots of lessons learned. Mm-hmm. But let's start out with Guilty Pleasures. And mine is so embarrassing, I think it has to wait to the end. But Jeannie, what's a book or an author you will read that you don't want to admit it, you're just with friends?
Well, it's a genre. I love to read rock star autobiographies.
Ooh.
Did you do Keith Richards?
Of course.
Yeah.
Eric Clapton. I particularly liked Ronnie Spector.
Oh, I bet that would be great.
Baby. Mm-hmm. Another good one was by Patti Boyd, who really was not a rock star herself, but she was married to George Harrison and Eric Clapton.
Yes.
So she's got some credentials. It's called Wonderful Today, because the song Wonderful Tonight was written about her. And, of course, the Patti Smith autobiographies are very interesting about her relationship with Mapplethorpe and that sort of coming of age in New York.
When you were five, did you want to be a rock star? What's the genesis of this obsession?
I guess I read them because I lived through all of this music. And so it's interesting for me to see the backstory, the sort of infrastructure. For example, did I know that Ronnie Spector was basically enslaved by Phil Spector, that she was basically captive in this house?
Mark's coming out of his chair. I think he knew
Southern
that.
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, you didn't know that?
I knew that Phil was a little off.
He was
a
total control freak.
Wow.
Did you know that the background singers for Be My Baby did not include the Ronettes, included Cher,
yes, didn't know this one. Yeah.
Sonny.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Just this. Everybody who Phil Spector knew just came into this studio, and Ronnie sang the lead, and the Ronettes, her sister and her cousin, were, you know, back in Queens, just cooling their jets.
That's pretty nice, though.
That is.
Yeah.
That's a cool guilty pleasure.
Yeah, that's a really cool guilty
pleasure.
Yeah,
Have you read anything by Stevie Nicks or like Fleetwood Mac?
No.
I hear
Captain and Tennille.
No, that does not intrigue
rest
me,
I have to say.
I ask because the stories that you hear about Fleetwood Mac are like legendary tales of excess.
Yeah.
You know, like during the taping of Rumors, which I think, yeah, because we played it on Tony's show today. The Rumors was released on this day in 1977.
There you go.
Yeah. And I would like to read Stevie Nicks' tales.
And I will say, when you read Keith Richards' autobiography, you think, how can he be alive and fill in the blank, not be alive?
In that book, he keeps saying that he's alive and relatively healthy because of the drugs, which is a bit counterintuitive, but it seemed to have worked for him.
Yeah, it does work for him.
I mean, the guy fell out of a coconut tree and had a concussion.
Okay. Michael, I'm kind of guessing, being your background and your smarts, you don't have a guilty pleasure of reading.
Oh, I definitely do. And after hearing Ms. McManus's, I'm a little embarrassed. We're in the circle
just
of
wait,
friends.
Just yeah. wait. Don't Mine worry. Is yeah, so embarrassed.
This started when I was in college, and I was an English major with a minor in classical studies. So I like to read historical fiction, and I liked it to keep me in the world that I was studying, but also be a little bit frivolous, a little bit fun. And this continued when I was teaching high school kids. I'd like to try and read, I would tell myself, some of their books as well, so I'd always be current. No, this is a historical fiction series, and I'll name one in particular because I think it really covers what I read when I have just the time to escape. And it's the All Souls trilogy by Deborah Harkness. And this has to do with vampires, witches, demons.
I know we a family, the... a couple, I'm sorry to interrupt, we'll get right.
No,
a family and their son who live by these. They live by these. They read them together. Go on.
So this is not like the 50 Shades of Grey vampire Twilight type fan books. This is an academic who herself is a historian, introduces this very strong female lead who is an Oxford scholar. She studies alchemy. And when she is in the library, the very famous Bodleian Library, she discovers that she's able to pull this ancient manuscript, and in doing so, discovers that she's now the focus of a very important vampire and vampire clan, along with all the demons and witches and vampires in this whole area. Tori is judging me. I can feel that.
I'm going to be so embarrassed when I do mine.
This is also the first book was turned into a miniseries. That was, you know, the same feel. It's campy. It's fun. It has a little bit of romance if you're into that. And in book two, I'm not going to give away too much. They end up doing a little bit of time travel. And so for the English major in me is nerding out as they go back to 1590 and visit Elizabeth's England. And she's hanging out with all the characters she studied her entire academic life. She's getting to meet Christopher Marlowe. She's getting to meet Sir Walter Francis. And she gets closer and closer and closer to her subject matter. But really, it's just going to be something that lets you see a little bit of how we all interact with those who we're supposed to hate, who we're supposed to see ourselves as different from.
Well, now, have
of course
you read
he pulls
the
it out and makes it sound
have
meaningful.
Have you read the Anne Rice books as well?
I have not.
Because I was going to say, that is kind of one of my guilty pleasures, but it was so long ago that I read them that I didn't dare bring it up. But
no,
it's
this
kind
includes,
of in the
you know,
same...
There's a couple of authors that every 18 months they come out with, think of, say, any Dan Brown book. They have that type of Mad Lib books. Think of, okay, plug in Templars, plug in, you know, stolen technology in 2018, and they're going to cross paths over a couple hundred years, and it includes ex-military who are trying to save the world as, you know, humans are about to unleash some new ancient, you know, weapon.
Excellent. Did you ever tell your students that was your guilty pleasure reading?
Yes. I think it's incredibly power to own what you like to read for leisure.
Yeah.
So kids can see the intersection of, say, your academic lifestyle and what you're reading for fun.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Mark?
By the way, don't worry. I will be the most embarrassing of all four of us. Mm. Trust me.
Betcha. $5.
So I love science fiction. And there is a very obscure series called Hellfort's War. I think it's about 4 or 5 books by a guy named Graham Sharp Paul, who is, I think, an Australian guy. And he served in the Navy, so he has some military background. So,
of course he does.
And there's it takes place like, you know, I don't know, 1,000 or 2 years, you know, something way in the future. But he incorporates stuff that seems reasonable. You're like, oh, yeah, that seems like a natural progression of how humanity will go. There's all these developments with technology that he incorporates into it to make it seem completely plausible. And, of course, we've explored all these other planets, and now there's this one planetary system that is essentially run like a Soviet bloc. You know, it's a very sort of totalitarian state. So there's a war between the Earth planets or whatever, the Earth Federation and these other planets. It's dreadful. It's dreadful. And I've read through this series like 5 times. And every time I'm like, I need something to sort of escape from this, I go to that. And he's, and unfortunately, as the series goes along, it's almost like Mr. Paul, you know, sort of just lost interest in it because it does not end well. But the first few books, it's fun. It's just really good fun, sort of gripping action.
So far, Jeannie's the coolest one of the group.
I know.
We may be revealing more of ourselves.
It's who I am.
It's cool.
We might be revealing more of ourselves than we want to. Okay, I can crush you all. So a little context, this won't be quite so embarrassing. And I don't travel as much as I used to for work, but I used to travel a lot. And my rule always was on the flight to somewhere or intermediary flights or travel, I would work, and not drink at all. And whatever my last flight or last train ride or last whatever home was, I would drink and not do any work. And I would watch trashy stuff on the TV and or read trashy books. Nicholas Sparks.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not familiar.
The Notebook.
Notebook, Dear John, Longest Ride, Michael Strinehart, not to burst out laughing.
Corey, if you're a bird, I'm a bird.
It's the worst. It's the worst.
He just knows how to keep hitting that note, doesn't he?
Yeah. I'll read you a quote. This was from one called Dear John, which was, I think this was a flight home from somewhere, and I was drinking in altitude, and it was about a guy who joins the military, and I'm just in tears the whole time. And when the flight attendants came over, are you okay? But here's a quote. And when her lips met mine, I knew that I could live to be 100. And visit every country in the world. But nothing would ever compare to that single moment when I first kissed the girl of my dreams and knew that my love would last forever.
Tori, you're right. This is the most embarrassing.
I win.
Yeah.
So where would you keep these books
Slam
in your
dunk.
House if you save them?
That's a great question.
Public bookshelf upstairs.
I might be in an airport in name the town anywhere in the world, and I would look around to make sure no one saw me buying it. And then when I got off the plane at Dulles or National or whatever. I would throw it away. Yeah, I probably should have given it to somebody.
I'm
going to
bring you in a copy of The Battle at Moons of Hell.
Thank you. Yeah, we could trade. We could absolutely trade. Okay, why do people like guilty pleasure reading? I started talking to folks about this weekend, watching that dreadful game last night. Everybody's got them.
Because,
is it just a little place to go?
Yeah, because sometimes you just want to veg. You just want to sit on the couch like a large cat and just snuggle up with a book.
Right. If you're at the beach, you don't want to be reading Tolstoy. You want to read something light. It's like, okay, it's compelling enough or it's interesting enough, and I can sort of move along with it.
Well, and interestingly, I read the Ronnie Spector autobiography at the beach, and at the same time, on Fresh Air, Terry Gross had this wonderful bunch of interviews in which she interviewed Benny King, another person I have a huge crush on, and Ronnie Spector. And of course, interviewed them and played their music. And I was sitting on the beach listening to Ronnie Spector and Benny King, and I just was transported.
That's kind of highbrow.
That sounds like a nice time.
Yeah. Highbrow.
That's kind of highbrow.
Yeah. Ronnie Spector.
Okay, Mark, that's the end of this segment. Now what do we do to introduce our next segment, which is to introduce your book report task?
Okay, so we had this idea we should do on a rotating basis.
We had this idea? This was your idea.
Well, you said
this
we need ideas.
This is all falling on your shoulders.
Yeah. Move it along.
Yeah. Kids.
It's Jeannie. She's an editor. There's too much fat in this. You got to trim it. Come on. So we thought, one of us every month, I guess, is going to have?
I think once a month is going to be plenty.
Yeah, once a month, somebody will get assigned to a book, okay, without their choice, apparently. And you'll have to read that and come back and report on that book. So, because this is kind of what normal book clubs do. You got to read the book and everybody got to talk about it or whatever. So this is sort of like a combination between that and a book report from back in high school.
Michael, teacher in the room, what would you require in a book report?
Ooh. So I've never had to give a book report.
Never?
No.
You went to all these nice schools in D.C. You never gave a book report?
I, as a student, maybe in lower school, probably up to fourth grade, you're usually going over, you know, character, plot, conflict, all that sorts of stuff. But after that, I would say for this, I might encourage our student, Mr. Mark Stern, to come up with a thematic question that he wants to explore that we can then go on that journey with him.
Should he try to convince us to read the book? Is that part of his task? And how much time are we giving him for this?
I think about 30 seconds. Yeah. I think that should be enough.
Maybe 45.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say within that thematic exploration, sort of the conclusion can be, you know, get up on your soapbox and tell me why I should or should not read this, or, you know, show me how it might be relevant, though I might not expect it to be so, to my life or to my interests.
Okay, and in the guise of often, so for instance, in debate club, you'd have to take the point, the side of an argument you don't want to take and argue it. Michael, you've come up with a wonderful idea for a book to take as our first.
Now, wonderful is a subjective term.
All right, just
you set this up, honey.
Accept it.
So I would like Mr. Stern to read The Virgin Suicides by Jeffrey Eugenides.
Oh, yeah.
Now, if he wants to do a failsafe, he has a movie that
That's
was very
right.
highly received.
Sophia
and
Coppola was the,
Now, I think you might like it because it really brings in music. And what I'm interested in is the exploration of obsession, particularly with young boys as they view women, particularly the young girls of one family, a neighborhood family, as something that they can consume. They are not just tracking them, they're seeing them, they're sort of writing into their lives. And we're going to see how tragedy affects this family as all the sisters go down the path towards suicide, how it affects the
Don't
school.
Don't do his book report for
the school
him.
Itself.
He's just going to listen to this podcast and then spit all that right back.
No, there's a wonderful exploration if you want to take a look at the town itself as a character in addition to the group of boys and the group of girls.
I think your expectations for me are very high. But all right, The Virgin Suicide.
I think our expectations for this particular segment are going to be low.
I don't know. This sounds like a good book.
Yeah. Have I ever talked on this show?
I get to pick the next book, right?
And you get to pick who does the next book report.
Don't give me naval history.
Because you ride me hard, McManus. I'm going to give you CrossFit on war. How about that?
Not give me naval history.
Have I ever talked about the paper I did on Jungian philosophy and Lord Jim?
No.
Have you
ever talked about that? 10th grade. Do not ask me why.
10th grade.
Do not ask me why I picked this topic. But I wrote a paper on using Lord Jim to explain Jungian philosophy. You could pull a gun to my head. I could not tell you why I chose that. And I'm pretty sure the reason I'm not sure about the Jungian philosophy side, but the Lord Jim side, I had watched the movie and was in love with Peter O'Toole.
Of course.
Didn't know he was gay.
Yeah.
So anyhow, I'm writing the paper. It's 4 o'clock in the morning. I got to turn it in at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I hadn't watched the whole movie, and I clearly had not read the book. And to finish my paper, I needed to know the ending.
Yes.
So I'm waking up my father, who had probably come in from the hospital 2 hours before. And I remember my mother rolling over going, he's going to kill you. If he realizes why you're asking him this, right, he's going to kill you. Well, I finished the paper. I turned it in. I got an A+. And a couple years ago, I'm cleaning out the basement, and I found the paper. And I'm looking at it, and it is as if someone else must have written this paper. It was so well done.
I've had that experience. It's like, who wrote this? Who was this person?
Well, I'm friends with my teacher at the time. Her name's Vicky Palinko, and she and I used to laugh about our names. And I called her up, and I said, do you remember any wild chance? I said, I don't even understand this paper now. How could I have written this? And she responds to me and says, we were so stunned when we read this paper because it was so good, we assumed that you had stolen it from somebody or paid somebody to do the paper. It's just absolutely remarkable. But anyways, so Mark, we'll look forward to that segment. Book Tank, Book Report, not sure what we're calling it. Might be the last time we ever do it.
Oh, yeah, so I'm the only one that has to do it. I love it.
Okay.
No, I will do this to the best of my abilities. I'm looking forward to it. And I'm looking to pass the baton on to the next person.
I have a unit plan if you want that.
No.
Chapter by chapter notes.
Let
guided
him fly
reading
solo.
Questions.
I'm going to fly solo on this. I'll be good.
Okay,
I'll
but maybe we
I
can.
I made it through college.
We can introduce the idea we were talking about before the show. Michael, it was right before you got here, and it was based on thinking about Mark's book report assignment. And I've been approached by a lot of people, nice, wonderful people, of interesting, obscure books about things, and they'd like to be on the show someday, which is great. But what if we did, you know, the show Shark Tank? What if once a month we had Book Tank, in which people came in and they would have 5 minutes or less to pitch their book, tell us this is what the book is about, here are reasons people should read it, and us, the panelists, get
to vote. We ask them questions.
We ask them questions and we push on them. But then we get to vote and we get to pick a winner.
I'm all in.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Can I play Simon Cowell in this?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Where is Susan Boyle, by the way? Remember her?
Oh, yeah.
I think she's still singing.
With her sensible shoes.
I think she had a nervous breakdown at some point, didn't she?
There were some issues, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Well, still dreaming her dream of times gone by.
You'll have to read that music biography. That's the next one, the Susan Boyle story.
I don't think there is one.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, our authors of the week, Eric Schmidt and Tom Shanker of the New York Times.
That's right.
I'm not familiar with that paper. Is that a new publication?
It's just starting up.
These guys have written a brilliant book called Counter-Strike. It's incredibly important. Can't wait to get these guys in studio. They'll be with us when we come right back.
Welcome back. It's Chatter on Books. We're at the corner of Wisconsin Avenue and Jennifer Streets Northwest at Chatter. Come on by. And the coach is coming in later. We are now on to our Authors of the Week segment. And I'm just smiling as I look across the table and see these two guys, Eric Schmidt and Tom Shanker. Just on your bios alone, we could go on forever and ever. National security, Pentagon, European correspondent for the Chicago Tribune before the New York Times, Tom, right?
Yes, indeed.
But you are the rock stars of national security and terrorism for the New York Times. What we like to do in these segments is a little bit on you guys, a little bit on the book, a little bit what's going on in the world today. So I'm trying to think alphabetical. Eric, we'll go with you first. How did you get into journalism? What did you want to be when you were 5 years old?
I wanted to be a baseball player, baseball announcer, if not a player. And it soon became
what
quite apparent.
What kid grows up and wants to be an announcer instead of a player?
Oh, you know, you sit
at
there
five,
and you,
you,
you do play-by-plays.
Suck.
Yeah, you listen to ball games, and I was a big San Francisco Giants fan growing up in the Bay Area, and they had great announcers back then, so I'd imitate the calls on the radio network. Because it became clear early on I did not have the talent to be a good baseball player, but I got into the writing gig instead. I was a journalist in high school newspaper, college paper. Lived in Madrid for a while. I was in college and did some freelance reporting there. So that's what the bug that got me.
Nice. Tom?
You know, a famous family story, my senior year of high school, the guidance counselor called me in and said, I hear you don't want to go to college. Why is that? You know, what do you want to be when you grow up? I said, I want to be a stagecoach driver. You know, you get to be outside a lot, work with horses.
You're old, but you're not that old.
Yeah, and so the guidance counselor said, that's not very realistic, really. What do you want to be when you grow up? And I felt like being honest, I said, my lifetime goal is to be Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times, to which she said, that's not very realistic either.
More likely you could be a stagecoach driver.
Exactly.
I don't believe that.
It's true.
What was going on at the time that made you want to cover the Pentagon for the New York Times?
Always been interested in military affairs. My uncle, who's my godfather, hit the beach at Normandy with 1st Infantry Division. My dad was in the Navy, served on the first warship that integrated African-Americans and black officers and crew. I grew up with sort of these images of how interesting and important the military should be. But I was also in a band. We used to play anti-Vietnam protest rallies. So I kind of played both sides of the question.
What was your favorite song?
Wooden Ships.
Mm-hmm. Can you remember some lyrics?
You don't want to hear me sing. My son says my voice is like goose farts on a muggy day.
Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Yeah,
yes,
exactly right.
I know it well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy to say things have changed a lot since you guys got into journalism. When I think back to when I first worked with and for you all, because that's what I did, I worked for you, at the Pentagon, which was pre-social media, how much have things changed since you got into this business, and what's the impact of the internet / social media on what you do now?
Well, it's a huge story. I mean, both Tom and I started in the day when, as a print reporter, you'd come in and show up, and you have this leisurely schedule, at least leisurely comparison to now, where you'd kind of work on your story, you'd file for print deadlines, and at midnight, at the latest, usually, you were done till the next day, and then you kind of started the whole cycle off. Now, reporters, including us, but younger reporters, I mean, you are expected to get out there and be on social media. If there's a breaking story, you've got to get out there. Get it tweeted out first, get your following behind it. You're then, you know, you're crafting a couple of sentences, getting a news alert out for the New York Times, nytimes.com. And after that, you're off and running. It's all day.
24/7.
It's a lot of work.
That's
it. 24/7. We have three news hubs, New York, Hong Kong, and London. And just when one closes, it hands off to the other, and it's continuous news.
Is it good news?
Mostly it's good news. In the New York Times, I think we try and keep the standards high, but it's tough. You know, we're challenged in this kind of environment where speed counts to keep it accurate as well and keep the context. So that's the challenge I think we're all facing.
You know, how it affects me, I left the Pentagon beat 5 years ago.
You're management now, aren't you?
I clawed my way to the middle, yeah.
He's an editor, genie.
And Eric still has an honest job. But what's interesting, Eric's described the incredible challenges, but it's also an incredible bonus. Think about how the Arab Spring was covered. We weren't on every street in every Arab capital,
right.
but Twitter
think about
was.
How it occurred.
How
it wouldn't.
It occurred,
I gave
exactly.
a speech years ago saying it wouldn't have occurred if it weren't for social media.
That's absolutely yeah. valid. And think about if Secretary Rumsfeld had been on Twitter without you to edit him, Tori.
Oh, be so spectacular. We would have laughed even more. Yeah.
Right, right. So I mean, it's a lot of challenges. As Eric said, the New York Times is both AP and CNN, as well as the New York Times. Because we want all of our products to be at New York Times quality, but we are covering breaking news every minute, 24/7.
Yeah. And you can still wander, not that you guys are covering the Pentagon day to day, but you can still, if you're a reporter, you can still wander around that building, right? Which was something, I think, there are a lot of people who have lived and worked in this town who didn't know that the Pentagon was, I think, the only federal agency where reporters not only had their offices there, but could wander around the hallways.
Absolutely.
At will.
And before he resigned last December, one of the greatest places you do is if you want to get Jim Mattis, you'd hang out at his favorite dry cleaner spot right off where the yeah. metro exit, and you could interview him right there. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs would come down and get his own coffee. I remember Richard Myers when he was doing that would do that. So the access that you have in the Pentagon with a few classified spaces is really unparalleled
yeah.
given some of the other offices in the government.
I also thought very healthy. It was always funny when foreign delegations would be visiting and they'd be wandering around and they were just horrified, absolutely horrified that we would let you all run loose. I found it very useful myself. When I first took that job or first agreed to take that job, I talked to a lot of my predecessors. I talked to every living Assistant Secretary of Defense. What do I need to know? And they all said the same thing, which is the reporters will always know more than you know because they're wandering all. You're busy trying to put out stupid fires. They are wandering around the buildings. They're talking to everybody. They will always know things before you know them. And it was absolutely true.
Yeah.
Absolutely true. So management, how is it, Tom?
Management, it's interesting.
Do you get to edit Eric's stuff?
I don't edit Eric too often. Occasionally I'm breaking news, but Eric, uh-huh. There's a national security editor, a very talented woman, mm-hmm. who is she tries to whip Eric into shape.
Eric, how is he as a boss?
He's
not that he's your boss, but what do you hear from him?
Tom runs the trains in our office now, and we've got a much bigger office thanks to President Trump. We've increased by, I don't know, 20 or 30 reporters, editors, videographers.
Is this in the Washington Bureau?
This is the Washington Bureau of the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
We are one of the biggest operations within the New York Times in terms of churning out news. Sometimes 15, 20 stories a day.
Have you guys? I'm sure you haven't a chance to read Jill Abramson's book yet, which I want to read. I'm a big fan of hers, and I've read some pretty interesting things about it, but talking about how fast the world changed under everybody's feet.
You should get her on the show.
I'd love to do that.
Yeah,
she's pretty cool. I remember years ago, my son went to Wake Forest, and a few different people, including Al Hunt, who's a big Wake Forest guy, were trying to get Jill Abramson to be the commencement speaker, and she was very, very busy. But then she agreed to do it, and the next week was the week that she left the New York Times.
I mean,
it was a great get.
People often ask sort of, what are the biggest changes to the New York Times since President Trump was elected? And as Eric said, the size of the bureau, we grew from 60 to 107, so major size increase. We opened,
which is not what people think of these days.
That's right.
Yeah.
We now open the bureau at 6 a.m. every morning because the president—
To cover the tweets.
To cover the tweets, that's exactly right. And we are staffed until midnight, and then we turn the news over to Hong Kong and then London. And we've also done some very interesting hires. We have two fact checkers now. One is Linda Q, who fact-checks everything that's said publicly, not just Trump, but the Democrats as well, because, you know, we want that. And we've also added three news assistants, added their responsibilities. They read all of our stories. The reporter, of course, is responsible. Every story is edited twice. But we now have a fourth layer of fact-checking, because any mistake, however innocent, can be weaponized against
yes.
us.
Yeah,
and we just
so
have
true.
To be that much better. Mm-hmm. So those are the new things.
But there was a shift to the we'll come to the book in a minute, I promise. But there was a shift to the New York Times after Jason Blair, right? About let's get back to really fact-checking, to really being sure about what we're putting out there in the pages, right? And then this is just on warp speed now.
Yeah, the main thing after Jason Blair and after the aluminum tubes is the use of anonymous sources was put under very strict control. Editors now have to have a conversation with the reporter And Eric, of course, one of the best source reporters in Washington, now has to discuss with his editors who the sources are, just with one editor. Very confidential, but you have to have that satisfaction for every reporter in the Bureau. And we also no longer use direct anonymous quotes because they were...
You can explain those to our podcast listeners, direct, what that is.
We can paraphrase information without an attribution, but we will never quote somebody saying, oh, Tori Clark is a so-and-so.
Jeannie, how's it sound to you as an editor?
It sounds spot on. And I would say that I so enjoyed the documentary, The Fourth Estate, about the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. My friends Liz Buemiller and Bill Hamilton from my days at the Post were there. And it hit me so hard how different the world of journalism has been and become in the last 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, whatever.
But yeah. Again, the dramatic change in the industry is phenomenal. Okay, we're talking to Eric Schmidt and Tom Shanker, New York Times rock stars and authors of Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda, which a lot of people on 9/11 didn't know how to spell. As we were saying before you guys came in, I could take one page of this book and go on for half an hour. I promise I won't do that. But you both knew a ton about national security, terrorism efforts, anti-terrorism efforts, as they were back then. You knew a ton because you were in that building every single day. What did you learn writing this book that you didn't know? Because there's a depth of information here that wouldn't come out in your reporting at the time.
Well, I think what we learned about Al-Qaeda, as you said, Tori, to begin with, most people in the government and in the general public did not know what Al-Qaeda was, who Osama bin Laden was, how terrorist networks operate. And so after the 9/11 attacks, there was real fear about what was coming next. What were the follow-on attacks? Who were these guys and how powerful were they? I think one of the things we tried to peel back in this book was to kind of show how terrorist networks are made up of networks within themselves. They have fighters, they have financiers, they have logisticians, they have different parts. And if you can go in and just knock out the legs under one of these parts, if you can cripple one part, say the finances, for instance, dry up the financing for a terrorist organization like Al-Qaeda or now ISIS, you can do great damage. You don't have to take the whole organization on at once. And I think that was part of the initial mistake, was the thinking was, oh, we just knock off some of the top leaders. Well, not with these organizations. They just grow new leaders overnight, and they put them out there. But if you can start knocking out how these organizations operate and weaken them, you take them down to size, and you can go after these kind of terrorist networks. And also, you take away their sense of invincibility, I think, that a lot of people felt. Or at least you can humanize them. These are a bunch of thugs out there that have gotten they got lucky, and they were good on 9/11. But how do you go after them now? I think there's a systematic way, Pentagon, counterintelligence agencies, Treasury Department, State Department, everybody kind of working together in the government had to figure out. But it took a few years for people to get on the same page.
One of the things you guys got to pretty quickly, which I remember we struggled with at the time, was everybody has frames of reference, right? And we're used to fighting a country, and there are boundaries, and there are armies, and this was completely unlike that. And even within, just stick to Afghanistan, even with Afghanistan, sure, we had the warlords who all got big, important titles. But there were tribes within tribes. And the sense, all the sort of easy buttoned up vernacular that we have didn't apply in this instance. And it didn't apply in terms of communicating, but it also didn't apply in terms of fighting it. I remember talking to some of the special ops guys very early on, the ones who had gone in on horseback, who were on horseback with the Northern Alliance tribes, and Rumsfeld meeting with them. It was the end of 2001. Tom, you might have been on that trip. And Rumsfeld saying to them, as he always did when he met with people, what do you need? And they said, we needed to have been here 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And we need to know the people in this village, and then we need to get to know those people in that village. And that's so hard, one, just to prosecute that kind of military campaign. Really hard to explain to the American people and other publics, this is what we are up against. Do you guys remember Dustum? Remember
Yeah, absolutely,
right?
Sure.
I think he became the defense minister for
yes.
a while.
Mm-hmm.
So when you travel with people like Rumsfeld and others, and you're going and you're learning lots of things and reading lots of things, and there's always the briefing book with the sort of one or two pager from the CIA about this is not classified information, it's some background paper on the people with whom you're meeting, and we're going to be meeting with the new Minister of Defense, Dustum, and it's describing his rather colorful past. And my favorite paragraph is which they described about how he put a great premium on loyalty and honesty and integrity among his people, and someone had not exhibited that and had stolen something from somebody else in the group. And Dustin decided to make an example of him by tying him to the treads of a tank and driving him around the courtyard of his facility. And then we walked off the plane and met him.
Right.
There you go.
That was December 5th, 2001. Rumsfeld was the first cabinet.
December 5th? Yeah.
Rumsfeld was the first cabinet secretary to land in Afghanistan. It was Bagram Airfield.
It was very dark.
It was very, very dark and very, very cold. But your point about how we define the adversary, you know, Eric and I really tried in our book to, you know, unpack the parts of the strategy that worked. But Tori, what you just said, I think to this day stands as the biggest failure of those years. Because people were defining terrorism in terms that had been applied to the Soviet Union and its nuclear arsenal, people said Al-Qaeda was an existential threat to the United States. And what that word means is they implied that Al-Qaeda could destroy the existence of America like the entire Soviet nuclear arsenal. And again, any death above one, above zero is wrong. But Al-Qaeda could never really destroy the existence of America.
Right.
Think about it. But decisions were made. Laws were broken. Actions were taken. Torture, rendition, black sites. Because the word existential was applied to this threat. Hmm. And it just never was. And again, I'm a very apolitical person. But when you think about the political debate today over is immigration an existential threat? What is and what isn't, those echoes of 9/11 can still be heard. And I hope the American public is smarter today in understanding that if you incorrectly define the threat, your policy is going to be wrong.
I agree. And this is the most serious show we've ever had.
It is.
Wow. It's about terrorism.
This is not like Sarah Pekkanen and the cheating wife. Wow.
That's page 72.
I was being reminded of a lot of things. And yes, and I understand this. We want things done simply, and we want things cleanly. And if there's a problem, we want to fix it and then move on to the next thing. And one of the things that occurred to many of us at the time was this was not if there ever is an end to terrorism, but it was not going to be this problem, this challenge was not going to be solved just with the military. And I used to stand up at that podium. I used to say to lots of people, this is not just about the military. It's economic. It's legal. It's financial. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And everybody in the U.S. government has a role in this. And it was a nice thing to say, and some of us wanted it, but it didn't really occur. And there were plenty of people, and I understand this, who just want, no, we're done with that, we're moving on, right? We're moving on. But, and understand that, you know, I have a very small mind here. You talk about in the book a whole new use of deterrence. Right? We all think, as old-timers think of deterrence in terms of the Soviet Union and Cold War and nuclear weapons. But there did arise out of all of this and trying to figure out how to address this, a new version of deterrence. Tom?
Sure. You know,
in a few words or less.
Yes. As both you and Eric have said, there's no way to kill your way out of this problem.
Right.
And you have to get left of the problem. You have to, as Eric said, disrupt the networks that provide the oxygen, the money, the personnel. But you can also set up enough roadblocks and hurdles and dissuasions and disruption that you can begin to mimic Cold War deterrence. Al-Qaeda really didn't want to fail. 9/11 was such a spectacular success that by so many of the defenses the U.S. put in place, the Al-Qaeda leadership said, let's not do that attack because if it fails, we'll be humiliated. And that deterrence saved countless lives.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Cyberterrorism. We barely talked about that in 2001, barely. And now it's a huge deal. How's this transformation come about, and how big a threat is it now?
Well, it's huge. And if you read the latest, or saw last week, the presentation by the president's top intelligence chiefs, it's top of the list. You know, whether cybercrime, cyberterrorism, the threat of attacks, cybercrime, terrorism from countries like China, from Russia, from Iran, possibly from North Korea. Disruption against the government, disruption against American industry, financial institutions worldwide. It's a big deal. And right now, part of the problem is talking about deterrence is with conventional weapons and nuclear weapons, things like that, you could demonstrate, you know, here's what happens to you if we catch you doing this. With cyber, it's hard to do that right now. It's hard to figure out, first of all, who's attacking
you. Who's doing
it. Yeah. Exactly, the attribution, they call it, and how you get back at them. And if you do want to strike back, what are the kind of what the follow-on consequences are if you want to attack? And certainly some of the first glimpses of this we saw in the attack against Iraq in 2003. If you wanted to bring down the networks there, but what kind of ripple effect might that have throughout the region? Anybody connected to those networks now? And I think a lot of the problem is we don't know what that might be, or what the retaliation might be too. So it's very difficult, and all these things are moving at such incredibly fast speeds that it's very difficult to kind of get your arms around that.
One of the things that really struck me as I was reading your book was how many smart people in how many different agencies and departments are working on this problem and are plugged into this problem. And not to force you into a political corner here, but to think that these people's advice is being overlooked or ignored seems so foolhardy. I mean, you would mention people and their education and their department and their commitment, and I thought, how could we have so much knowledge and passion about solving this problem and have it be, in some cases, overlooked?
Do you mean...
Am I forcing you into political corner
no,
here?
I know exactly what you mean. And again, reading the book reminded me a lot of things. A lot of it was this thing in the early 2000s, this big desire, let's never let this happen again.
Let's work together.
Let's never let this happen again. Let's get these bad guys and let's move on to... And so there was this sense of, let's get this over with. And there were a fair number of us who said, oh, this is like the war on cancer. You never really win. This is going to be a chronic condition that we probably have with us for a long time, and it takes different forms. And I think you guys speak to that. And then, but more directly, I think, Jeannie, to your point, the sheer weight or the sheer force of the bureaucracy of those kinds of places makes it very hard for innovative thinking to break through, right? It really, really does. I'm obviously in the tank for Rumsfeld, have been for a long time, and I sat in many, many meetings where he would say, what's wrong with the way we're thinking about this? Why aren't we doing this differently? Mm-hmm. Right after 9/11, he was saying, we need to think about this, we need to think about that, things that were years down the road. And lots of people who worked for him did not respond. But I think I'd love to hear what you guys think, because you saw it from a different perspective.
Well, I think the point you're making about the bureaucratic inertia can only deal with so many problems, and it's front and center. Tory will remember in June of 2002, so the first phase of the Afghan operation was over. It was a success. And even though Eric and David Sanger and I were writing that you all were preparing for with Iraq a year later, you weren't talking about it. But we were at NATO, June of 2002, and Rumsfeld briefed them on the Dark Wind exercise.
Yes.
It was a classified study that Rumsfeld had commissioned that posited that a terrorist brought smallpox to Oklahoma City,
right,
infected 3,000 people at a shopping mall. Within 90 days, 1 million dead, 3 million sickened, and nationwide riots because the public didn't trust the government to take care of them. I would guess that today, defense against smallpox and the amount of vaccine is no more than it was when Secretary Rumsfeld raised that risk to NATO in June of 2002.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And it was a good risk to raise. Do you guys remember anthrax?
Yeah.
Right? Remember when anthrax happened? Anthrax, not communicable, can be treated. The panic in this town, pediatricians had armed guards at the doors to stop the crazy moms from running and screaming, going, I want my child vaccinated, I want my child vaccinated. People went nuts over that, which is a sign of the kind of panic that could ensue. This is a really cheerful, uplifting program, isn't
well,
it?
We went into the post mail room really, with really gas fun. Masks on, basically. Yeah.
So to paraphrase you guys at the end of your own book, how does this end?
Well, what we talk about, and it was somewhat questionable what was going to happen here. Of course, we end as they're killing bin Laden, and we're kind of looking ahead to the next version.
Right.
You know, the problem is you can kill the leaders, but you can't kill the ideology. And it's interesting because that's kind of where we are now.
Yeah.
You know, the President Trump will go on television tomorrow night, State of the Union, and probably declare some version of the caliphate, the Islamic State caliphate in Syria has been defeated. Now, what does that really mean? Okay, they've lost their territory, but they haven't lost their fighters. They've gone underground. Their ideology is now global, fueled by the social media. And so what happens next? We're looking probably to the next generation coming forward. And that's kind of where we were in the book, is how are we as a public going to deal with this kind of threat if we're constantly being threatened either from the outside or as the threat is now, from within, homegrown terrorists, mm-hmm. whether it's in Orlando, whether it's in San Bernardino. And do we have the resiliency as a public to understand, okay, these guys are a bunch of thugs, we've got to mourn our dead, clean up afterward, but push on and not let the terrorists defeat us in that way, not let us defeat us in our democratic values and change the laws and such.
Yeah, and I'm sure Rumsfeld said 1,000 times, for 200-plus years, we were blessed by unique geography and good neighbors, and then that doesn't work anymore. And even the words you use, Eric, territory. Al-Qaeda's definition of territory is very different than our definition of territory, and their sense of time is very different. I've always likened it to much more of a chronic condition. So Tony Blinken, who was Deputy National Security Advisor under Obama, I guess, wrote a piece the other day, and it was essentially about the Trump administration not prepared for some inevitable crises. And he ticked through the crises, and you guys have talked some potential crises. It might be Iran. It might be North Korea. It might be a cyber attack. It might be homegrown. Based on your experience and what you've seen recently to really get people scared, what do you think is most likely?
So I hate to be really pessimistic.
Go ahead.
But to answer your question, I went back and read Rumsfeld's confirmation hearing.
Uh-huh.
50,000 words of Q&A. Uh-huh. The word Afghanistan did not appear once. And 10 months later, Afghanistan defined our country from that day to today.
Yeah.
So fair question, Tori. I have no idea.
Eric?
I think it's actually in this last intelligence assessment, but you look at climate change, and we see all around us mm-hmm. and the impact that it has. And interestingly enough, you ask, well, why would the Defense Department care about climate change? Well, it has a huge impact, first of all, on just your bases. Most of the Navy is based on coasts, of course, and they've got to deal with that. But more important, if you're looking at instances around the world where whole swaths of Africa or Asia are suddenly losing water. For instance, Yemen is losing drinking water. Mm-hmm. And this is pushing more and more people to migrate. You have migrant flows, as we saw. And, of course, one of the greatest political disruptions we've seen in the last several years is in Europe, with the migrant flows there. So you have this kind of effect of climate change pushing population movements around and having a dramatic political impact around the world. These are things that you might not think about as national security threats, but they are, and the Pentagon at least has recognized them that
yeah.
way.
One of the last trips I went on with Rumsfeld, which must have been early summer of 2003, and we went to Ethiopia, and went to Djibouti, capital which is Djibouti.
Djibouti.
Because it sounds so great the first time. You
Robin,
want to say the second time.
Robin Williams was in Djibouti on a USO tour, and he said, if this isn't the end of the world, I can see it from here.
Yeah, yeah. And I think Eritrea. And those visits tend to have kind of a set pattern. You meet with this person and that person, and you sit down. He would sit down with his counterpart, and you talk about the normal things. And in each one of those places, about 2/3 of the way through the set pattern, his counterpart would lean forward and put an arm on. Yeah, yeah. But here's what we need to talk about. We need to talk about the Saudis fueling the madrasas. And you guys talk about in this book, for every X dozens, hundreds, thousands you may kill, they are growing new ones. And they're even more extreme, and they're going to cause even more problems. And it was chilling at the time, and I still think about that today. And there seems to be less of the, you know, every time we killed one, it would fuel 50, it would inspire 50. I think maybe there's less of that, but maybe I'm just being optimistic. Maybe not. And to your point, Eric, maybe we're inspiring homegrown people who just go, well, that looked like fun, and I'll be famous for this, right?
Well, it shows just kind of how the enemy out there, whether it's Al-Qaeda and now ISIS, are adapting. They see it's harder to basically break into this country. We've increased the defenses.
Right.
So they say, okay,
We'll
just go around you, and yeah. we'll just try and infect the people who are already there, give them the ideology through the open internet, through social media, and we'll turn your own citizens and residents against you and try and track down the onesies and twosies that are out there. It's really difficult for the FBI and police
yeah.
departments around the country to do that.
And, Tori, it's to your point. You talked about terrorism as a chronic health problem, and it is. I mean, it's not just poverty, but it's poverty of education and poverty of opportunity and poverty
yeah.
of hope. And until you solve all those poverties, that rich tapestry
yeah.
of problems in the world, there will be terrorism.
And, okay, this is just, I'm going to go do shots of whiskey after this. one of the things, again, it came out so much in your book, Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda, which everyone should read. We talked in this segment with you guys about how much the internet and social media has changed your worlds. It's changed their worlds as well, and it's made it easier. In 2001, we still were talking about making it hard for Al-Qaeda to train and equip and prepare in Afghanistan. Deny them that. That was physical stuff that you could talk about. Now they don't need it. They don't need a physical space to train and prepare. Okay, this has been great. Been really cheerful. We'll end it with this. We got to go to our deserted island recommendations, but just bear with me, Mark. Give us a reason to be optimistic about what the U.S. government is doing, if you can. Tom and then Eric. 30 seconds or less.
There are a lot of smart people working in the government, and they're very dedicated, and with the right leadership, and I'm not commenting on any particular leader, this country can really do amazing things.
I think divided government is good. You've got a House controlled by the Democrats, and a lot of people who've come in with this new class have experience, particularly in national security. So I think, you know, hopefully we'll get some things done, maybe not immediately, but at least there's a Congress that will have some teeth and some accountability for the executive branch, and that's what it's all about. As accountability. It's what we do. It's what other branches, it's what other institutions are doing, too. It's important.
Very cool. What you guys do is important. So keep doing it. And thank you. Stay with us because we're going to ask you for your deserted island recommendations. Mark, you're up first. Shockingly, it's going to be some naval, military, historical crap.
Oh, yeah. The island music. This is, you talk about quality production elements right here. So we're back, and we are going to get going here with our recommendations. If you were stuck on a deserted island, what book or what books would you recommend for our fine listeners? I have the microphone. Do you want me to start off, Tori?
Yep.
All right. Tori makes fun of me because I always have military history books, and I'm going sort of in that vein again. Everybody here familiar with the movie Breaker Morant? Okay.
Yeah.
It's a great movie, right? It's actually based on there was a book by Kit Denton written in 1973 called The Breaker, which is the story of Breaker Morant, and it goes back into his backstory and all the way through the trial and everything. And it's, for those of you who don't know, it's a story about an Englishman who fled to Australia for a variety of reasons and then fought for the Australians in the Boer War, which was a very complicated conflict. And he did some things that were rather questionable, and depending on what side of the fence you fall on, he was either doing what he was told, following orders, or he was a rebel and he was just executing prisoners because he was mad because they killed his friend. And it's a brilliant movie, and it is a brilliant book. Kit Denton, The Breaker. That is my recommendation for you. And so I'm going to turn it over to somebody who's smarter than me. Michael, what do you got?
I'm actually going to recommend something that's out in hardcover right now. This is Once Upon a River. This is by Diane Setterfield, and this really is a story that celebrates stories. We find ourselves on the banks of the River Thames, and there's an inn that welcomes all storytellers, and a girl seems to come back from the dead. She washes up from the river, and this group of storytellers tries to find truth within that, and it sets up a few different stories of loss, of potential triumph. And really, I think I focused on the language, and it becomes a story of the river itself. The river becomes a central character. On one side of the river, we have what you believe, what you want to believe, what you've been told. And on the other side of the river, we have science, we have truth, we have a changing world, we have fact. And the river itself is unrelenting. You have a river that is strong, forceful, as a family deals with the loss of a child. But at the same time, along its journey, it can also become a very strong and powerful trickle as you deal with systematic abuse for certain characters. So it's a really captivating story.
Excellent. Jeannie?
If you are so sick of celebrity chefs and their sort of overhyped egos.
Well, they've all been fired because of hashtag Me Too,
yes,
but go ahead.
Well, here's one that isn't. I highly recommend a book by the most charming man I have ever met, Jacques Pepin, The Apprentice, about his growing up, like at age 4, working in kitchens, and the sort of strict French coming of age that he had in French kitchens. And it is charming. It has traditional French recipes sprinkled through it. You can only go to YouTube and look at his YouTube version of making a French omelet. It's not every omelet. It's a French omelet. And to see what a charming, perfect man he is.
Excellent.
It's really a wonderful autobiography.
Excellent. Eric Schmidt?
So I'm from the West, and so when I'm getting down, I'm being caught up in
terrorism.
The terrorism issues, whether here in Washington or New York, I transport myself with anything written by Ivan Doig. Ivan Doig was a great writer of Things of the West, and my first city editor in Kennewick, Washington, gave me the book This House of Sky, which is a story of a young man growing up in Montana.
I may have actually read that book.
It's a beautifully written book, as are all of his books.
Does it have horses in it?
Evocative images, beautiful writing. If you're a young writer, it's a great great book to copy. And so I love going back to him and just kind of tapping into my Western roots when I feel the need to recharge.
Nice. Tom?
So if the question is what book I would take if I was stranded on an island, the first would be a survival manual.
I would be able to survive. It was a trick question. Okay, that's what we were looking for.
So, but the book, it's a book I read every year. It's called The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov. He was a Soviet author suppressed under Stalin. And the conceit of the book is that the devil walks the streets of Moscow showing, the terror of the Soviet regime under Stalin. But at the end of the book, it's really a celebration of faith and true love.
Nice. Lovely. Very, very nice. You can tell they're good writers because they can say these things cleanly and succinctly. Mine should really be Michael's because it is, and I'm trying to find Pete McDaniel. Pete McDaniel's a guy who wrote, he's a golf writer, and he wrote a book several years ago called Uneven Lies, which is about African Americans and professional golf. And Washington actually plays a really important role in blacks breaking into golf. But 1896 U.S. Open, I think. An African-American dentist invented the golf tee. It's an absolutely fascinating story, and a really good case could be made that golf would not be what it is today without them. And it's a wonderful story. And if anybody's listening, I'd love to find Pete McDaniel because I think he'd be great to have on the show. So that is our show. Thank you, Tom Shanker, Eric Schmidt. You guys are fabulous.
Thank you.
Scary, but fabulous. Thank you very much. Next time, have something a little more cheerful, a little uplifting. Something about a rock star we would like. We are back next week. Chatter on Books with Dan Pink. Who's a really, really fabulous guy who's written several very successful books about business and time and kind of anthropology. He's fabulous.
We'll see you guys next week.
Thanks, guys.